Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 164 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined this episode by co-host Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hey, Max. It's great to be here after missing out on a couple shows ago with lovely Irene passing through and yesterday, last week without being able to record a bit for the show. So good to be back.
Good to have you back. Now, David Vanderhoof, who normally joins us, is not here this episode. He's got a little bit of stomach flu, it seems, so he's taking a pass on this week. So we look forward to having him back next week. And if that's not enough, Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog, he's also off this episode. I think he's off on a boondoggle somewhere. So we went looking for a substitute for Rob that was up to the task of replacing him. So that took all of about 3 minutes, and we're happy to say that Benay Wilson from Aviation Week and the Aviation Queen herself joins us as guest co-host. Hi, Benay.
Hi, Max. I am so happy to be here.
We're so glad to have you back again.
It is good to be back.
Now, our guest this episode has been on the show before, and we're very happy to have Henry Hartevelt back. Hi, Henry.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me to return.
Dan tells me that you have a new job. Is that right?
That is correct. So thank you, Dan. I am now one of the co-founders of Atmosphere Research Group. I've left Forrester, and we are starting a new marketing and technology research firm that is going to focus on the airline and travel industry, as well as a few other consumer service areas such as healthcare, retail, and financial services.
Oh, interesting. Okay, we'll look forward to talking about that in a little bit more detail later on.
Okay.
First, though, we have some aviation news from the week. After that, we'll talk to Henry about his new endeavor and some other things. Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast have their Ozdesk report. They recorded that on location at the Coldstream Aerodrome for the Australia Center for Mission Aviation. And then we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment where we learn about the Vickers Viscount. And then we'll close up with a little bit of listener mail. So why don't we get started with the aviation news? You guys all ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Now, we're recording this Sunday evening, September 11th. And, of course, it's the 10-year anniversary of the that tragic day that really changed aviation in a lot of ways. Also, obviously, affected a great many people, the victims in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania and their families as well. And it's been kind of an emotional day, I think. Probably all of us have watched some of the coverage of the memorial services on television. We did want to talk a little bit about the effects of that day on aviation. We have an article from Consumer Reports. It's titled, How 9/11 Really Changed Flying for Consumers. Now, I'm not sure all the items in here are really the direct result of the attacks on 9/11. Some of these things, I think, maybe were other forces, but there are certainly are some things that are the result of what happened on that day 10 years ago. So we wanted to talk just a little bit about what some of those effects have been. And I think, guys, the first one that the article points out is maybe one of the most obvious ones, is the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, was formed. And that certainly represented a big sea change in terms of what commercial aviation is like in this country and really around the world.
This is Henry. And frankly, I think from the Consumer Reports article, the only item in it is the federalization of security. That is the only thing that you can really trace back to 9/11 and say this happened, and as a result, we changed. Because the decline in competition, changing business models, other things like that, the unbundling, the decline in jobs, really didn't have so much to do with 9/11 as it did the fact that we've had two recessions, we've had a massive change in the number of people who choose to fly, oil spikes, and so on. And certainly the TSA and some of the more intrusive ways that airport security is done may have suppressed travel, especially in the short haul. But there are a lot of other factors unrelated to 9/11 that have changed, and I think we really need to keep things straight.
Yeah, I think, Henry, I would agree with you on that. I think, yeah, some of the economic forces swirling about in the last 10 years have had a big impact on commercial aviation, certainly. Binay, let me ask you, what impacts do you think are important for us to think about?
Well, I think that I'm going to look at it from the passenger point of view. I think that we, as passengers, are much less complacent about our flights.
Mm.
If something is going on, and I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, I think people are, even 10 years later, just hyper aware of everything that happens on a plane. So they're much more likely to report anything they think is strange behavior. If anybody is in a flight, you know, when the plane is flying and does something that's kind of, you know, uncomfortable or unusual,
right,
or even outright crazy, passengers are much more likely to jump in and assist flight crews.
And we've seen that several times in the past. Sometimes when maybe, you know, concern wasn't warranted, and, you know, people were removed or even arrested, and, you know, maybe they didn't really need to be. But, yeah, it's true. People are very, very aware of what's going on in and around them and in the airplane and at the airport.
The crews themselves are also much more aware and much more aggressive. And I think, unfortunately, they are more likely to presume that people are guilty until proven innocent. I mean, we've seen some things happen where crew judgment sometimes has to be questioned because they're basing this based on incomplete facts and some potentially, frankly, unpleasant behavior, stereotypes and so on. While I respect the fact that crew members want to and have a responsibility to keep their passengers and themselves and the aircraft safe, I think that we're seeing some people jump to conclusions in the wrong way, and it becomes embarrassing, and it only serves to cast a negative light on air travel, and I think contributes to people's desire to look for other ways to get around or just avoid traveling altogether.
Or even drive them to my side of the industry, private aviation, if they can work it out.
Yep, good point.
I mean, you know, this is the topic that I write about, and I've actually, you know, had the chance to fly on some private aviation flights. And I mean, who wouldn't want to do it? I mean, no hassles, no taking off your shoes. You know, you get on a nice, comfortable plane and all the amenities and a flight attendant that's actually happy to see you and wants to serve. And
yeah.
I kid. I know that all flight attendants aren't like that. So, but, you know, it, and, you know, being able to go from point A to point B quickly, and sometimes even in just one day. So the hassle factor, I think.
Sure. So, Dan, do you have any thoughts on this? You must have been about, what, 10 years old when?
I want to say 11.
Yeah.
I was in sixth grade. And it was just a weird day because I was being dropped off at school right around the same time the first plane hit, and I guess just because they felt we're too young, the teachers didn't tell us anything, but you could tell something strange was going on. So then to learn all the news when I got home that day was kind of weird. And honestly, I think for my generation, I usually don't think about 9/11 from an aviation perspective. I just think about it really. I'm not sure if a loss of innocence is the right phrase, but it's almost, I think, a lot, at least for me, and I think a lot of other people in my generation, that was the event that made us kind of wake up, and just we were reaching the age to start understanding world events and to start, you know, tracking what was going on in the world. I mean, and I think before that day, most of myself and most of my friends couldn't even point to places like Afghanistan on a map, and we kind of woke up quickly.
Yeah, the world significantly changed on that day.
I mean, I was working for Mesa Air Group in Phoenix, and that morning I was actually leaving to get on a plane to go to Washington, D.C. to do a little lobbying.
Wow.
I don't know why Jonathan thought that was a good idea, but, you know, there you go. And
yeah.
I, you know, we were 3 hours behind because I was, you know, Phoenix does not have daylight savings time. And I was watching ESPN because I had missed the Monday night football game. And one of our board members called me and said, you need to turn to CNN. And I turned just in time to see the second plane hit the towers. So I said, I better go into the office. And my dad called on the way in a panic because he knew that I was going to D.C. that day. And, you know, I'm a grown adult, and he's telling me I cannot go to D.C. He's like, you will not get on a plane today. Well, it's like, Dad, come on. What am I going to do? Tell Jonathan, oh, my dad says I can't get on a plane. Yeah. You know, but, you know, obviously I wasn't getting on a plane that day. So, and it was surreal for being at a regional because a lot of our planes landed in places they had never landed before. And I spent most of my day working the hotel desk, using my Amex, getting hotels for our crew members who were scattered literally all over the country.
Yeah, I think it's one of those major events where anyone who lived through it remembers where they were, what they were doing, you know, on that day at that time. And that's the way it will always be. Okay, let's push on and look at an article from Aviation Week, actually. This is by, let's see, who wrote it? Guy Norris. 737 MAX was no surprise, Airbus says. So the Boeing Board of Directors has given the go-ahead to re-engine the Boeing 737, and Boeing has decided to name that the 737 MAX. Thank you, Boeing. I tweeted to Boeing a little message giving them my permission to use my name in their new for their new airplane. So, but I didn't hear back from Boeing.
They're usually very responsive on Twitter.
Not to that one though. In this article, there's some quote from Barry Eccleston, the Airbus America's president, and he says, "We reached a conclusion a year ago that re-engining was the way to go. We were not ready for the production of a single-aisle composite aircraft, and the market reaction to the NEO, that's the new engine option, the re-engined Airbus, proved we were right. We always thought Boeing would come to that same conclusion, and they did." So I guess one way to put this is that, you know, the drama is over, or really is the drama over? I mean, both the major airframers have decided to re-engine their existing single-aisle aircraft, the Airbus A320 family with either the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan or the CFM Leap X, and Boeing offering just the CFM Leap X because they have an exclusive agreement with Boeing on that plane. So, I don't know. What do you guys think? Is the drama over?
I don't know. And the reason I say that is Airbus certainly has been getting some orders, and that's terrific. I'm not so sure that airlines are thrilled, just, you know, jumping out of their shoes for joy and excitement with what Boeing has proposed. And, you know, I can understand certainly that it takes a long time to develop a new airplane from the ground up,
sure,
if you will, and a lot of money. And Boeing doesn't have either of those right now. It needs to start collecting orders for new aircraft. My concern is that Boeing is playing it safe, and in doing so, they may get some orders now, but I am really impressed with what Bombardier is doing with the C-Series. I was just up there last week touring the factory and seeing what they're doing. The potential for the C-Series to go up to 150 seats is there. I wouldn't be surprised if Bombardier started getting interest from airlines in something maybe a little bit larger, and I also wouldn't put it past Embraer to pursue this. And we don't know what China is going to do in terms of developing its 100 to 150 seat jet, and if they do, and they bring in something that is really viable in terms of safety and economics for the West, Boeing, you know, maybe facing a real ugly future in the single aisle airline market, at least in that 150-ish seat range, you know, 120 to 180 seats.
I think the drama isn't over. I think what we've been waiting for a while is just clarity. So for a while we said, okay, well, the C series is out there, but we don't know what the rest of the players are going to do. So now we have C series Neo, 737 MAX. So there, at least there's some clarity on there. But as Henry said, I think it'll be interesting to see how the C-Series works out, especially, you know, right now the C-Series, the larger version, is around the size of an A319, 737, 700. So it'll just be interesting to see how airlines decide, if they decide, well, could we just go with a C series and go with Boeing and Airbus for the larger variants, or does it make sense to just go with a whole family and we'll, there'll be some commonality benefit there. So we'll have to see what happens. Also, the other interesting thing is that Boeing, when they put out the releases about the 737 a couple weeks ago, they said they had commitments for 496 airplanes from five airlines.
Yes.
But they didn't say who those airlines were.
But Southwest is apparently not one of them.
Yeah, the Star Telegram had a quick blog post saying that a Southwest spokeswoman said that we are in the discussion phase only. So and something like this would be appealing for Southwest because, you know, this would just follow. I mean, they love the 737 family, obviously.
Sure.
They followed the evolution of that airplane from the 200 to the classic, now to the NG. The other question for Southwest, though, is how the 800 fits into everything. Because right now they have 25 coming, and the question is, how does that number potentially grow in the future, and would a re-engine 737 be part of that? So I guess to make a short story long, the stage has been set, but there's still plenty of drama to happen.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, when it's Boeing and Airbus, there's always going to be drama. And back in 2008, in March of 2008, I did an interview with Gary Kelly for Aviation Week, and we were talking about what was then being called the Next Gen 737. And it actually kind of, just this one little paragraph kind of exploded into a mini drama, because in that story, Kelly was talking about how Boeing wants them to be the launch customer of their next-gen aircraft, but it hadn't been sorted out before all the details hadn't been sorted out. And back in 2008, Gary Kelly was calling for a next-gen to be out before 2014. But he was like, we're pushing for that, but we're not predicting that will happen. So obviously, you know, that he was right with his prediction. But I think it says a lot. It's very interesting that, you know, that Southwest is kind of sitting on the sidelines watching this play out.
And I actually once had a conversation with Herb Kelleher, and this was also, I want to say, it may have been 2009. Herb Kelleher said at the time that they'd been pushing Boeing for a redesign on the 737. That they were interested in new airframe, new wing, new engine, all of that, to get better economics. But what he also said was that just because Southwest had been a loyal customer with Boeing and had been a longtime user of the 737 didn't mean that they would just blindly stay with the airplane, that they felt that they had a responsibility to themselves, their shareholders, their employees and customers to look at whatever else might be viable. Now, you know, talk is cheap, and I'm not sure what he said and whether he said that was definitive, but you know, I thought it was very telling that he made this comment, frankly, I thought it was a very smart comment for him to make.
The one thing that I will find interesting is what airlines end up ordering this airplane, because if we use the Neo as an example, I would say that a good number of Neo orders, except for American, were orders from very loyal Airbus customers.
Yes, right.
You know, like the JetBlues of the world. You know, so they get the benefit of they keeping a lot airframe commonality mostly, I believe, and then, you know, new engine of course, but there is a commonality benefit. So the question that I have in my mind is, could Boeing attract some new customers with this airplane, or will it mainly be existing 737 customers?
Probably both Boeing and Airbus want to protect the customers that they already have. Yeah, a lot of what we've seen so far seems to be centered around that. What it really comes down to in the end, though, I guess, is winning over converts, customers that historically gone with the other guys. And I don't know, we haven't really seen a whole lot of that, I guess.
Well, Max, you know, I think you make a good point. Certainly, Boeing has been very successful in selling the 737 airframe over time to a number of airlines around the world. But it's a combination of the aircraft's performance, economic performance, of course, fuel consumption, things like that, the plane can be operated in, but also, very importantly, the financial terms. What kind of assistance will Boeing provide, or what kind of other assistance can be provided to get the carrier, or for, again, don't forget, it's not just the carrier, the leasing companies, to order the aircraft. And certainly Airbus has been very, very aggressive in that area. And it's just like with buying a car. You may really want car A, but if car B is pretty good and pretty close and they give you better terms or on a lease or a loan, you're going to go with car B.
Yeah, that's huge in this industry. Absolutely. Now, we see in Flight Global, an article by Lori Ranson, that U.S. Airways says takes preliminary look at A321neo. And this is kind of centering around a replacement for something that can replace the 757. Isn't that kind of the big issue there, Dan?
Yeah, and basically, I think what this article shows is that right now an airplane like the A321neo can fly the vast majority of 757 missions, but it's these missions on the edge, these slightly further out missions, so Phoenix, Honolulu, or East Coast U.S. to Western Europe, that it looks like, possibly the A321 probably won't be able to do. And that's what it appears that U.S. Airways is concerned about. And now what I'm interested in is how does a re-engine 737-900 look compared to a 757-200? And can that airplane fly those longer missions? That was my key takeaway there.
Now the Dash 900 becomes just the Dash 9. Or maybe there's no Dash, right? It's just a 737-9? Is that how they're talking about designating the models?
I don't know. Good question, bro.
Stumped Dan. Yeah, I think they're dropping the 900 becomes the 9, the 800 becomes the 8. I think that's what they're doing.
Is that kind of like 50 is the new 70?
Yes.
Or 70 is the new 50, whatever. I don't know.
And actually, this rebrand, instead of just re-engineering instead of a new airplane, kind of disappoints me, and this is a totally random tangent. But I have been pondering since I was like 10, what happens when Boeing runs out of numbers? And by doing this, they have bought themselves some more time. But I want to know what happens. And I've been worrying about this since I was a child.
I have to say, this is, I really hate to absolutely admit this, but I'm with Dan. I have been worrying about this too. And it kills me to have to say this. Oh,
okay, well, I'm going to just put it out there that you're both losers. I have not been worrying about it. I've certainly been wondering and been curious about it. But remember, when we already saw this with the SST. Now, Dan, I don't want to hear that you weren't alive when Boeing created the SST, because knowing you, you probably have a model somewhere in your storage chest. But Boeing was originally going to call its SST the 2707. And so I think that Boeing certainly can work on a number of different things to approach this. And let's not forget that Boeing's marketers very successfully, I think, branded the 787 the Dreamliner. And there have, I think that they could decide to go with a product name for certain airplanes in the future as opposed to model numbers.
Well, like they did with the Sonic Cruiser.
Exactly. And we saw how successful that was.
Well, yeah.
But it was nice looking.
Yeah,
it was nice looking, but it was a name. It was a name. Binet is absolutely right. There was no number associated with it, unlike the 787.
Yeah, that's a good option. All right, let's talk about slots. Boy, we haven't talked about slots in a little while. This is another Aviation Week article. Low-cost carriers jockey for position on National and LaGuardia slot auction. This article says low-cost carriers are engaged in a tactical battle over how the FAA would auction off slots at New York LaGuardia and Washington Reagan National if the agency finalizes its approval of the deal between Delta and U.S. Airways to swap a large number of their slot holdings at the airports. Dan, every few months, slots comes up. Dan, is it different this time?
No, this is basically an extension of what we talked about last time. The DOT, a while ago has tentatively approved this slot swap between U.S. Airways and Delta after approved it. This is actually round two. The DOT/FAA/whoever approved it the first time around, but U.S. Airways and Delta were unhappy, basically saying that because the government wants us to divest this many slots of these airports, the deal really isn't worthwhile to us. This time around, government has tentatively approved the deal again with divestitures still, but U.S. Airways and Delta appear much happier with these terms. Right now, the process that we're going through is a bunch of airlines are commenting on the divestiture process. And a lot of airlines are excited about these divestitures because it's very hard to get slots at LaGuardia and National. So this presents a really great opportunity for smaller carriers to get into these airports. And so what we're going through at this point is these airlines are commenting on how the divestiture should take place. So right now, the FAA is proposing that the slots should be given out in bundles of 8 slot pairs or 16 slots. And there will be 2 bundles at LaGuardia and 1 at National. So a few airlines like Frontier, JetBlue, WestJet, and Sun Country, they would like smaller bundles. They think it would work better for them. And actually, Allegiant, which I found very interesting, commented on how they would prefer smaller bundles at LaGuardia. So who knows, maybe we could see Allegiant coming into LaGuardia one day if this auction A takes place and B if they bid successfully, which would be interesting because Allegiant in the past has done secondary airports like Mesa and Phoenix or Sanford for Orlando, though granted they are at LAX these days. But Southwest has also commented on here. Southwest supports the bundles of these slots, and Southwest is big enough that they could probably make it work. So it'll just be interesting to see how this all works out.
I have to say I'm not surprised to see this because businesses in any area will come together only as long as it suits their collective needs. But when the individual needs become more important, then they all fall apart. And what you're seeing now is the smaller carriers basically saying, we want in, we want more, better and better access than we have, and you shouldn't let any of the larger airlines, whether they're so-called network or low cost, be able to play. You know, I have to tell you, I think that there is merit in, I think it was either ACI or some other airport group in that article saying, the slots don't belong to the airlines. The slots belong to the FAA and the airports and should be used for the greater benefit of the community. And while I think the Delta U.S. Airways swap makes sense at LaGuardia and Washington, I think that the airports should be sitting there saying, okay, forget whether it's low cost or network. How do we as airport operators best serve the needs of the community, and how do we make sure also that we are not beholden to a single airline? You know, I think that the airports that operate or have Fortress Hubs operated there are at their facilities are probably scared that they have to live and breathe and die by one carrier's requests. So I think it's in the airport's own interest to have fragmentation as well as the customer, because competition is what breeds better price and better service.
But Henry, you make a very good point, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. On the other side, you know, travelers like you and me, we want our regular frequent service. We want our regularly scheduled flights, you know, on the airlines that we like to fly. So, I mean, it's creating that balance with these slots. I mean, it's very tricky. I wouldn't want to be the one to have to do it.
Oh, I agree with you, Binay. I mean, but I think let's also recognize that unlike 30 years ago, when you had more than 24 jet airlines operating in the U.S. and then many more commuters that were prop only, you now have only 10 airlines in the U.S., including, by the way, Hawaiian, Allegiant, and Spirit, and counting AirTrans Southwest as one and United Continental as one. So the dynamic within the industry is very different today. You know, I think that the airports, also have the challenge of making sure that they don't give away so many slots that they end up with long delays for arrival and takeoff. I mean, there are a lot of different things that have to be balanced here. But I think that from the standpoint of the airport and the FAA and whoever else would be involved in assigning these slots, they really should be taking a look and saying, how can we best ensure future competition? Who is going to use this? And I'm very sorry, but an airline that wants to come in with maybe one or two frequencies a day, and maybe not even to using those frequencies to the same city every day, really shouldn't have access to an airport like LaGuardia. Binet, to your point, an airport like LaGuardia or an airport like Washington National, which is heavily focused on the business traveler, will need and will benefit from an airline that can provide a fairly consistent presence and provide the frequency that the business traveler needs and the leisure travelers benefit from.
Henry, this sort of goes to your point about what the airport's concerns about slot ownership. I'm not sure if you saw, but there was an interesting filing from your home airport in San Francisco about this. And to quote them, they say, "We are concerned about the incentives there created by the current proposal. U.S. Airways is being permitted to obtain monetary compensation from the sale of a de facto asset that they do not in reality own. Allowing U.S. Airways and other airlines to realize profits from the sale of slots creates a perverse incentive for airlines to add flights at congested slot-controlled airports, such as SFO, for the purpose of driving the FAA to impose slot controls," which I found to be an interesting argument.
I agree with you. Yes, it is.
Okay, so we have a story from CNN. This is Flyers' Saggy Pants and Skimpy Garb Test Airlines. The story leads with a rather disturbing photo that I think we've seen before. But this is concerning dress codes on the airline for passengers. And we've seen a number of cases where some folks have been removed, arrested because of how they dress. And in particular, we have this sort of saggy pants look that I don't know if this is a local phenomenon, a U.S. phenomenon, or if our listeners across the world are familiar with this. But if you're not familiar with this, it sort of looks like a wardrobe malfunction, I think. This is where one's pants are pulled down low, sometimes really low, exposing the underwear. And we've seen that the lead singer from Green Day was taken off the flight because he refused to pull his pants up. And we've seen one or two others of the same situation.
Well, I will jump in on this one because, you know, Max was being very delicate about it, but I will be direct. This is an African-American thing. Youth like to wear their pants baggy. It's a sign of street cred. I don't necessarily agree with it. I mean, I think it looks ridiculous, actually. But I don't think that it's enough to get people kicked off of a plane. I have flown a lot, and I have seen people wear some crazy stuff that I think would be much more offensive than the gentlemen with their pants kind of hanging down. I mean, but I think the problem that I have with this is it's so subjective. You could be on, let's just say Southwest, because this Southwest seems to be the one that's always in the news about this. You could be flying on six different Southwest flights and have six different crews that have six different views about what is appropriate to wear and what isn't. Mm. And, you know, if you look at the contract of carriage of most airlines, there is no specific rules or guidelines. They have this very loosey-goosey definition that, to me, is just a little too fluid.
Binet, remember also last year there was an issue of a flight attendant not recognizing someone who was an Orthodox Jew and was praying and engaging in behavior where they were bowing their heads and raising and so on and so forth and bowing their heads again in prayer. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the post 9/11 environment where the flight attendant took it upon herself to make a judgment that proved to be embarrassing. I guess I tend to be the type of person just traveling where I will dress for a mix of comfort, but also, you know, I don't like looking like a slob. That's a personal preference. I guess I would also say I'm very glad we're no longer in the Leave It to Beaver era where men are required to wear suits and ties or cardigans and sweaters and ties just to sit around at home on a Saturday. We are a much more casual society than we were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago, however long ago, even 10 years ago. But I think that what all travelers have to remember is when you are traveling, you are in public and a very unusual part of the public world. You know, you do have to go through security screening. You are with other people who, like you, have paid to be in on that airplane. I think you want to just dress with a sense of respect for yourself as well as others. You don't have to put on a tuxedo. You don't have to, you know, get all dressed up. But I think you just want to ask yourself, just because I can do something, does it really mean I should, if you think it could potentially cause a confusion or an unpleasant outcome?
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable way to think about it. I mean, not just your dress, but also your actions in the airport and going through security and so forth. You know, you need to be, well, you can be your own self. You can be a little independent, but you really need to think about the environment you're in and how you want to behave in that environment. It's not a free-for-all.
Yeah, and there's that again, there's that balance. I mean, I'm like Henry. You will not see me wearing blue jeans and tennis shoes on a flight. I just, you know, I grew up in an era where I actually had to wear the little dress and the hat and the white gloves. But, you know, you're not going to see me wearing that. But, I mean, I dress comfortably but professional looking, and I do the same with my daughter. It just makes me feel better. But, you know, again, there is that balance. I mean, and it's a tricky balance. I wouldn't want to have to make some of those calls, frankly. But again, I like Henry said, I think there just needs to be some common sense on both sides.
Again, our guest this episode is Henry Hartevelt. Henry, tell us again about your new adventure.
Well, we are starting Atmosphere Research Group as a boutique research and advisory firm. I'm going to head up the airline and travel practice. We will be looking at both industry topics and consumer behavior, and looking at topics such as e-commerce, distribution, marketing, operations, planning, those types of things within the airline and travel space. My two colleagues both have airline consulting background, also experience in different verticals such as healthcare and IT systems. And what can I say? What better time to launch a new research firm, which is a discretionary purchase, than in the midst of an uncertain economy?
Oh, absolutely. That's when the fortunes are made, Henry.
I hope you're right, Max.
Yeah. Is there a difference between an industry researcher and an industry analyst? Or are those the same?
Well, I'm an analyst. I think that it's the same. If you research, pretty much you're just gathering the facts. But if you're an analyst, you're taking a look at them and trying to determine and communicate the implications of the facts or the trends, whatever it may be. If you had asked me a million years ago when I was starting my career if I would ever be an analyst, let alone a co-founder of a research firm, I would have said, you're crazy. But I find it to be just really, really interesting. And it's been very, very enjoyable. I'm very, very grateful for the 11 and a half years that I spent at Forrester. And I'm excited about the opportunities that my co-founders and I have with Atmosphere.
And who are your target clients? Are those airlines?
Well, our target clients will be airlines, yes, as part of the mix, hotel companies, travel agencies, GDS companies, technology companies that want to sell into the airline or travel sectors, marketing agencies, and so on. I mean, it's generally, these are companies that either are in the business or in the industry or serve the industry or want to be able to serve in the industry. You know, what's really fun is the fact that in the role that I have, you get exposed to a lot of startups, and there are a huge number of travel technology startups being launched by bright young people. Not that I'm bitter about that, you know, they are incredibly creative and they come at it with a very fresh approach. And so the ability to help guide these folks also and help them understand industry dynamics and ways that they can be prosperous and successful is something that it's just great fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned, younger people. And the next thing I was going to ask you kind of relates to that. As we talk to our guests, one of the common themes is that we like to ask how, you know, young people can get started in careers along the lines that, our guest is in. And oftentimes it's around flying and becoming a pilot and that sort of thing. But, you know, certainly there's a lot of other jobs in aviation besides being a pilot. When you look at the area that you concentrate in, if someone is looking to develop a career in that direction, how do you do that?
I would first say that obviously you need to be very good with understanding technology and data and stats and stuff like that. But I would also say that the best way to get a job is to find an area within the industry that you're really passionate about and get in there and master it. But then leave that for something else of interest before you become too complacent or too pigeonholed. So my background includes marketing and advertising, frequent flyer and other loyalty program management, distribution, planning, and so on. And by having that mix of experience as well as having worked in the airline sector, the hotel sector, and travel technology firms, you can view my career as a stew or as a mutt or whatever it is. But I think just having something where you are able to build on it and from it and challenge yourself and while having fun. I mean, this is not an industry where you will probably make a lot of money, so it is critically important to have fun. But there are so many different types of firms that operate in and around the airline industry itself. There are technology firms that specialize in it. There are the carriers. There are the leasing companies. There are the distribution companies. There are travel agencies. There are the marketing agencies and others. You know, know what your strengths are and also know what you don't want to do. And then work on those strengths, but also make sure you challenge yourself in the areas that you're not particularly strong in, so that when you get to the point where you can assume management responsibilities, you have the necessary skills that you're not just your boss is looking for, but his or her boss, and maybe two or three levels up.
Now, these kinds of firms are not centered geographically in any way, right? I mean, there's no Silicon Valley for companies like this, is that right?
Correct. I mean, I happen to live in the San Francisco area. My two co-founders both are in the Boston area. Firms like ours tend to be, though, in major cities. So Boston, because there's a lot of tech out here in the Bay Area, New York City. But the jobs tend to be in many major cities, just because, again, these firms tend to be national in scope. In some cases, even worldwide.
Do you have your sights set primarily on U.S. domestic clients, or are you thinking globally at this point?
Oh, I worked for TWA. The world was the middle part of that airline's brand. I've got a globe sitting on my desk. We have some rather lofty ambitions. And the other important thing to understand is that the airline industry is not about the U.S. 85% of the airplanes right now that Boeing has on order are destined for carriers outside North America. Ours is an industry that has always been global, but the research we'll be doing will be global in nature because the carriers and the companies we do business with are, no matter where in the world they operate from, chances are they're serving multiple countries and in many cases multiple regions.
What do you think about Boeing's strategy to sort of globalize the supply chain? You know, talk about a global industry. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense, but the execution is what we've learned is key. So Boeing is not alone in globalizing the supply chain. Bombardier has a globalized supply chain. Airbus has a globalized supply chain. Embraer also. The question is, what do you choose to build and how do you choose to get it from wherever it's being built? And I think that ultimately is what was Boeing's big challenge with the 787 Dreamliner. Is not so much globalizing its supply so much as not really factoring in how they were going to get the parts from wherever they were being made to the final assembly point in a timely and economically practical manner. I think they've learned a great deal. I think that Boeing is a smart enough company that they will never allow themselves to make these same mistakes again. And I think a lot of other companies, regardless of the industry they're in, whether they are building airplanes or cars or computers or anything else, will look at what Boeing has done, both for the good and the bad, so that they can learn from the strengths and avoid the mistakes.
Dan, aren't you a supply chain guy?
Eh, not really.
I thought you were studying that in school, no?
I'm doing some classes, but I'm not like a dork in supply chain.
Okay.
I have a question for Henry.
Yes, Binet.
Henry, you know, you were talking about the areas that you're going to focus on. Can you tell us how different it's going to be with your own company than what you covered when you were with Forrester?
Sure. At Forrester, a lot of what I researched was related to e-commerce and distribution. And while that's very, very important because of the focus on technology, we'll be more comprehensive in our approach. We'll also have more content about industry drivers and writing more about industry behavior and results. And we think we'll have a different approach in terms of the consumer behavior, which travel clients have told us is so important to them because they want to make sure they invest their very limited resources in the areas that matter most to travelers or potential travelers.
Since you mentioned the technology, since Henry, you've been doing the TV circuit on this for so long, what's been going on lately with lovely American Airlines and Sabre and Direct Connect and all that good stuff?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is that we've seen American and Sabre postpone going to court again, and there are a couple of things going on. First, the whole nature of what American calls Direct Connect isn't really direct. It just goes through a different intermediary and one that can do different things, especially around ancillary services. It's also a lot more cost effective for the airline. So, you know, American, and for that matter, every other airline, every other travel company has a fiduciary responsibility to have the most cost efficient distribution strategy and system that it can find. You know, I would like to think, and I sincerely hope, that American and its distribution partners, whether it's Sabre or anyone else, can find ways to bury this hatchet, to that the GDS companies and other third parties will understand what's important to American and develop the solutions that are will be helpful and economically viable. That American and the other airlines will say, yes, these new solutions work for us. I really do see the future, though, being very, very fragmented because not every airline will choose the same distribution strategy in every market. And I think that it's going to be a big challenge for travel management companies, which handle corporate accounts, and leisure agencies, whether they're online or offline agencies, in terms of aggregating the content not only from airlines but from hotels and other suppliers. This is really an area where we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to the evolution. From what I've seen, the technology on the airline side isn't yet there to handle something like this. Certainly the travel agencies are concerned about financial arrangements and integration with their various systems. This soap opera is not over. I will just tell you that. You know, I think that if the Pan Am series on ABC doesn't become the airline soap opera, this one potentially could be an ongoing series.
All right, dumb question. Granted, that's the majority of my questions. But when you say that American's Direct Connect really isn't direct, what do you mean by that?
Well, what American is proposing is that they are saying they would like to take content that currently flows through GDS systems such as Sabre and route it through a direct connection between themselves and a travel agency. The truth is that that will be going through an intermediary, such as Farelogix, to the travel agency. So it's not really truly direct, but it certainly is more useful for American because Farelogix can handle a lot more of the ancillary product bundling and unbundling and selling within the system than the current GDSs are able to do. The GDSs have added a lot of capability in terms of helping airlines sell things such as seats and baggage checking and lounge passes and so on. But the system from Farelogix is capable of recognizing who the customer is and then extending not just the individual items but bundling it. you know, it certainly is again, competition is always good to have. But I think that Americans scorch the earth approach that they've taken has not exactly done them any favors. And I'm concerned may have cost the airline some money, at least in the short run.
Interesting.
Henry, when you were at Forrester, you were always traveling. You were speaking at a lot of conferences and industry events. Will you continue to do that in your new job? And where will we see you in the next few months?
Yes, I will be traveling. I was just in Washington speaking with the Society of Government Travel Professionals. And there are some other things. My schedule right now is just still being firmed up. I'm chairman of the Association of Travel Marketing Executives, and I will be at a couple of ATME events over the course of the rest of this year. You know, beyond that, I don't really know that there are any other public industry events that I'm speaking at. There are a couple of private meetings that I'll be attending.
Has Atmosphere Research opened its doors?
Technically, yes, but like every startup, you know, especially when you only have three people, we are doing wearing a lot of different hats. So we only have a placeholder website. We are still working on some of the marketing elements, but we are starting work on our first research. So, you know, we're trying to really keep the focus on all these different things.
Right.
We know we have a lot of work ahead of us, but we think over the next month we'll have dotted a lot of the I's and crossed a lot of the T's associated with starting up a new company.
Do you want to tell us your website name, or you want to wait till that's formally launched?
No, it's out there. And if you're interested in getting information, any of your listeners are welcome to go to www.atmosgrp.com. Again, it's A-T as in Tom, M-O-S-G-R-P.com.
Great. And let's see, where else are you? You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at H Harteveld, so that is H-H-A-R-T-E-V-E-L-D, as in Dan, T as in Tom, and I'm on LinkedIn.
Great. All right. Well, Henry, thanks again for coming back and talking to us about Atmosphere Research and what you've got going with that. We'll be watching you as that develops and look forward to great success for you.
Well, thank you. It's been a privilege to be part of today's podcast, and I appreciate the interest in the new company. It's sincerely appreciated.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline.
No. Well, you get it right. It's Dateline, September 10, 2011. Hi, I'm Anthony Simmons, and this is the Australia Desk.
It is indeed for episode 164, we think, because we haven't got internet connection here, folks. But welcome back to the Australia Desk, coming to you this week from the PCDU Mobile Studio. We're set up here at Coldstream Airport in Victoria for the Mission Aviation Discovery Day. And boy, I tell you what, hasn't been the best day for an air show, guys.
It's been a bit wet and woolly. It's been rain off and on, low cloud, occasional sunshine, cold, wind. Melbourne, spring.
But they did have free sausages.
Only at the end, after a few of us had paid for them.
Look, don't talk about food, please.
Sorry, we didn't mean to rub it in, Steve.
But how are you going, Steve?
Yes, down 16 pounds so far for our Americans, or...
What's that in Australian dollars?
Yes.
I think it depends on the exchange rate. It's about 74 pence to the dollar.
Yes, that's 7.5 kilos. Only about 3 tons to go.
You'll get into that light sport aircraft very soon, mate.
Yes, light. Never a word that's been associated with me, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about Ansett Airlines. Now, of course, we don't talk about them much because they actually perished on the same day that the World Trade Center's perished by sheer coincidence. And it's been 10 years, but finally the receiver that have been working very hard for all of this time have managed to get back a final settlement for entitlements that were owed to their workers to the tune of 97 cents in the dollar owed. So pretty good result, even though it's taken a long time.
I think it's actually testament to the administration process that was undertaken with Ansett that they have achieved such a fine result for their employees. rather than doing what the initial plan was have a rapid fire sale at the collapse of Ansett, and the employees were only looking at potentially getting their entitlements in the vicinity of 30 to 35 cents in the dollar.
Exactly. If they had have done a fire sale straight after Ansett went under, then it was depressed market, airlines were in trouble post 9/11, and then there was the SARS, the birds flu, all those kind of problems that kept people from flying. But now things are picking up again, even with the GFC, and it's been a lot easier to sell assets such as their simulator center and so on.
Well, in addition to the three of us being here, of course, Anthony Simmons, the infrequent flyer, who's stolen my studio, and we managed to track it down, and he set it up here. He's done a good job. We've also got Ben Ippolito with us, who does the air traffic control segment on our program. Ben, you've flown Ansett in the past?
I have flown Ansett only once or twice, though, being a little bit younger than other members of the podcast here. I'm the damn web of the group.
Such as myself, who's sitting here, who's done from Sydney to Adelaide return in the cockpit of a 727 with Ansett. My company that I was working for actually paid for me to get those tickets to go back and forth, and straight after takeoff in Sydney, I went forward and never came back.
Now, I can tell you through a family connection. Now, I actually grew up in a family that was associated with Australian Airlines or Trans-Australian Airlines, so I have never, ever flown a Ansett because that was just forbidden. But, Anthony, with your job, I mean, you've spent a lot of time doing a lot of business travel, yes. So I guess you would have flown around Ansett in the past. How were they as an airline? How would you rate them?
Well, predominantly the flying I did with Ansett was more for recreational, for on holidays, vacations and such like, but I actually found them a very good airline. Their standards of service were comparable to both to Qantas, and all in all, I'd say they did a very, very good job, and I think it was a shame and a disappointment that they closed, and closed in the fashion in which they did, and shut down literally overnight.
Well, they were in trouble for a while, and then they had the hassles with their 767s, some paperwork and maintenance issues that got them grounded. It was they grounded all the Ansett 767s, but not the whole of the fleet, nor all of the other Ansett aircraft. But that caused a lot of problems for them, and it wasn't long after that that they tried to get sold to Singapore Airlines, but that got blocked at a political level. Air New Zealand came in, and by that stage it was pretty much a big disaster. Air New Zealand, apparently back then government-run, stripped out a lot of assets. Then Ansett went belly up.
I seem also to recall, even though I am the infrequent flyer and know nothing about the aviation industry, that Ansett had a long history of ongoing problems in regards to maintenance because of the wide range and variety of aircraft that they used. There wasn't a standard for the fleet. It was literally they bought whatever they wanted at the time, which had an impact in parts, maintenance, inventory stocks that needed to be maintained, and that certainly didn't help the bottom line.
Yeah, training and currency was always an issue for them. I think at one stage they had probably about seven different aircraft types. I heard that quoted recently. And yeah, that does have a big flow-on effect because you've got to train crews to operate on all those different aircraft, and that's always going to be a very, very costly exercise. Not impossible, but you know, for our American listeners, you know, where you've got a huge population, you know, probably the economy there can support you know, a much larger range of aircraft flying within an airline. But here in Australia, where we've only got probably less than 20 million people at the time that airline folded, that's always going to be an issue. Ben, you're a commercial pilot as well, an air traffic controller, so that's, I mean, I think you were looking at the airlines at one stage. Did you ever look at Ansett? They had a pretty good training scheme going.
I was actually going to be an Ansett boy. If I had have had applications in with the two, my choice would have been for Ansett. But back to what Anthony said about the various types and things that they had, they did also have the three-crew 767 experiment.
Correct. That was the airline in the world doing
because of the engineers' union, they had to put that engineer station on there in what is essentially a two-crew aeroplane because it's designed that way. So they had that experiment, and then at great expense to the airline, they slowly converted all those aircraft back over.
But anyway, I mean, it's a good thing that, you know, the receivers there, Cord and Mentor, I mean, they have been working, you know, for a decade now to get that result, and I think that's the best they're going to do. They've, you know, had to sell off a lot of assets and try and get as much value back as they can. Many former staff that have been interviewed in the media this week all seem pretty pleased with that result. You know, there was quite an emotional time, and of course it didn't make a lot of news headlines at the time because of the events of September 11 obviously overtook that, but you know, I think a really good result, and I think most people will be happy with that.
Yeah, it is a shame that Ansett went. It's great that they've got their money back, but you're right, Veggie, that was a really weird experiment, having those flight engineers on the 767. I spent a little time on their cockpit, and mate, the guy's sitting there with one screen and a keyboard and a few buttons, and Yeah, it was really odd, especially when you're flying on other people's 767s and have seen them doing it all as just two pilots. So I don't know that that helped anything. It would have made it a lot more expensive and also made it very hard for them to get rid of those aircraft afterwards.
That's absolutely right. Well, guys, I tell you what, I think we're going to have to pack the mobile studio up here before we freeze to death. It's, I reckon it's, what do you reckon, sub 10 degrees here today for Celsius, so it's very cold, particularly after being in Oshkosh where it was about 300 degrees in the shade.
And even though it was mentioned briefly at the start, I think it would be appropriate that we do say that all of us are thinking of our cousins across the pond in America on the 11th of September. This is, of course, the 10th anniversary of that terrible, tragic occasion. Of which Australia has been inextricably linked. And I can only say, at least on my behalf and on behalf of the rest of the PCDU boys, that our thoughts are with you.
That's very true, Anthony. Thanks for joining us here today. And Ben, thank you for sitting in. We haven't had a segment out of you for a while, so it's we have to get you back and working, mate.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to get some time off, and I'll be in the PCDU Northeast studio shortly.
Okay, that wraps it up from the mobile studio here at Coldstream, the Mission Aviation Discovery Day. Grant, we'll be back next week.
Oh, very likely.
Cheers, folks.
All right, Steve Vischer sent along a photo of the four of them at their in their mobile recording gear, and so look for that in the show notes. Next up, we have Peter Johnson across the pond.
It is a member of aviation's aristocracy, but this Viscount emerged from humble origins. With new Rolls-Royce turboprop engines, the Viscount produced a breakthrough. Hundreds of aircraft were sold to 60 airlines. For the men who'd built the Wellington bomber, it was a triumph. By today's standards, the Viscount is comparatively primitive, but when it entered service, it was regarded as fast, comfortable, and at less than £200,000 per aircraft, a bargain.
Today, I'm joined by Brian Burridge, who is the co-founder of the Vickers Viscount Network and an ex-Rolls-Royce Dart engineer. Today, Brian's calling us from Chichester. Brian, welcome to Across the Pond.
Thank you very much.
Probably one of Britain's most successful post-war turbo prop aircraft. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Certainly. I would say it's the most historic passenger aeroplanes that the Brits have ever built.
Right.
It started off in 1943 as part of a committee of people that got together and were looking ahead of the end of the war. They didn't realise then when the war was going to end, but they saw there was a great need to improve the infrastructure for the civil aviation in the country. And they obviously approached a lot of companies that were geared up for wartime production and would have spare capacity after the war. And amongst them was Vickers. The issue became more of an engine issue at the beginning than an airframe issue, that they felt they could build an aeroplane, but they didn't have a suitable engine that somebody could supply. There were a couple of companies that came to the forefront. One was the Mamba, and the other one was Rolls-Royce. The committee were keen on a turbine engine. It was 46 before they really got to grips with designing something, and it evolved fairly quickly from there until the first Viscount flew in the late 40s. 1948 was the first flight. It was a fairly small aeroplane at the beginning. See, it was always going to be four engines. They wanted to sell it on the safety of having four engines.
Right, okay.
It took off from Wisley in Surrey on a grass strip, which today would be unheard of for commercial aeroplanes to take off on grass, but that's exactly what it did. To an extent, the rest is history. 444 were eventually built.
Yeah, and who were the biggest customers of the Viscount?
Well, obviously you had British European Airways. They had a vested interest in having a big network throughout Europe.
Yeah.
But the main issues were selling it to other European countries, such as Germany, and also breaking into the North American market. And
quite a few were eventually sold in America.
Yes, Capital Airlines was the biggest order. That turned into United at the end, but by the time United got it, it was pretty much coming towards the end of the turbine era.
Right.
But Capital absolutely loved it, and they made a lot of money out of it, although they didn't handle their finances that well, and they actually got absorbed into United.
Right.
But you had Continental Airlines and several others, and the public loved it.
Yeah, it was a very popular aircraft to fly in.
It was a slightly noisy aeroplane from the outside. On the inside, it was smooth, quiet, could fly above the weather, and was a great joy to the public to fly in, and it attracted an awful lot of people that had never flown before.
And the Viscount was powered by the mighty Rolls-Royce Dart. With your experience, what sort of an engine is it, and how easy was it to maintain?
It was a fabulous engine. Rolls had a lot of experience with the centrifugal compressor from the Merlin. So they devised and developed a supercharger with a centrifugal impeller.
And they're still in operation, Dart engines, aren't they?
They're still in operation. There's about 350 aeroplanes around the world, so roughly 800 engines still flying with spares.
And Brian, are there any Viscounts still in the air?
No. We kept hearing rumours a few years ago about one in Africa, in Zaire, or Republic of Congo as it is now, but that was more somebody's wishful thinking than anything else, and it's still been advertised as a flyable aeroplane, but when you look at it in photographs, it would never fly again.
Shame. So can you tell us what the Vickers Viscount network is?
Right, the Vickers Viscount network started off basically in 2004. I was buying photographs off of eBay, and I kept noticing this other guy was buying stuff as well. We were competing against each other.
Right.
So I emailed him and I said, look, are you buying photographs for a particular reason? He said, yes, I want to set up a website all about the Viscount, but I need some photographs. And I said, well, I've got thousands of photographs, I'm just adding to it. And that was Jeff Blombier. And 2005, we really got going on it. I provided him with lots of data, lots of history data, lots of photographs. And we produced this website, which has evolved to where it is today.
The website itself is one of the best websites I've ever seen, cataloguing the history of an aircraft, construction in the aircraft, full construction numbers, photographs, and all sorts of stories from around the world. What sort of membership do you have?
We have a general membership of well over 700 now, and we have a newsletter that goes out to every member as well. There are those that spend an awful lot of their spare time helping us research, producing material, producing photographs, going into archives themselves, going through a lot of data, and that can take weeks and years. Two guys, yeah. Richard Stanton and Julian Bourne, go into Brooklands Museum, go through their archives and find all the stuff that we need.
Where are some of your listeners, and how can our listeners get involved?
Simply by going onto the website, you can click on the contact us or join us. All we're looking for is some sort of information as to why they want to join.
Yeah.
And what their background is.
You've got some events running.
Last year we were at Duxford. We were hosted very well with the Duxford Aviation Society, who have the oldest Viscount in the world, so it was very appropriate to go there. This year we're going to Brooklands.
Yep.
And they have one of the later Viscounts there. And we're having a day there on the 1st of October. And again, within reasonable numbers, anyone can join us.
It's a really interesting itinerary as well. So anyone who wants to get down there, please look up the website. I was lucky to see many of these at Heathrow, Gatwick, Southend, and I certainly do miss that familiar sound.
Yes, as we all do, I'm sure.
Brian, thanks so much for sharing the knowledge you have on this wonderful airplane.
You're welcome.
Where can our listeners find you online?
Online, as far as the website's concerned, is www.vickersviscount.net. But even if you search on Viscount alone or Vickers Viscount, we come up almost top of the pile. And that's very much driven by how quality of the website is. And I have to say that Jeff should take all the glory for producing the technical side of the website.
Yeah, it's an amazing website. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You can find Peter Johnson at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com.
Okay, thank you, Peter. All right, I think we have time for a little bit of listener mail. First one comes from Alan. He writes, in today's challenging environment, how do you think airline operations, especially regional operators, could be made greener? Interesting question. Any thoughts?
The most dramatic way, really, is some kind of investment in new airplane. And right now, the only Binet tracks this industry better than I do, but there really aren't any shiny new fuel-efficient 50-seaters coming off the line, if I'm correct. So, I mean, you can have continued fleet reinvestment, and I guess compared to some other aircraft in its class, the Q400 does pretty well on fuel because it's a prop. But other than that, I mean, sort of the same solutions that exist for the rest of the industry, if it's investment in biofuels or the operational things like RNP.
I would agree with Dan. I don't see any new small regional jets coming up the pike.
It's Henry, and one thought I have is that, you know, how are we defining regional? You know, for example, is it the size of the aircraft or the range? But obviously, you've seen some newer generation turboprop aircraft like the Q400 that provide near jet-like speeds but are more fuel efficient than jets on the shorter haul segments. I think also looking at operational details, you know, do the aircraft need to run APUs? Can they use ground power? If that is more efficient, more fuel efficient, you know, I think that a key factor though is on the regional front. There's a line below which carrying passengers is not fuel efficient, especially because the added delays they contribute or traffic they contribute to the ATC system and volume of airplanes. You know, should we be saying, if in the interest of going green, larger aircraft, you know, and not allowing certain smaller airplanes to fly in and out of major airports? I don't know. Again, that's a policy issue.
Yeah, interesting.
And I think you also need to look at the financial bottom line. I mean, you know, the regional industry has contracted greatly since I started writing about it back in 1993. And, you know, costs are tight, just like with the major airlines. But I think it's kind of exacerbated with the regional as the industry continues to contract. So, you know, I think that you have to also look at the bottom line. Can you do some of these things in a way that adds to the bottom line? If not, I'm not sure if it's going to be the biggest priority.
Okay. Next, we got a letter from Dan. Actually, Dan relates an interesting, I guess, an amusing little story. Dan says, I love the shows and haven't missed one since I discovered you. He says, being British, I was very amused by Dan having a problem about the British always having a different version of history. He says, as a result, I thought you might be interested in something I heard earlier this year on a public tour of the vast Airbus production facilities in Toulouse, France. At one point, the tour guide said, this is a quote, the road we are now on is named after, and parenthetically, I can't remember his name, but French, of course, who was the first person in the world to achieve controlled powered flight. The Americans have convinced the world that the Wright brothers were first, but that is not the case. I thought that was pretty amusing.
I think we need David on here to really provide analysis.
So. I know. Everybody wants to be the first.
But I think the only conclusion here is that America is always right.
Well, you know, it's funny because our friends down south in Brazil also have staked their claim on being first in aviation. So, I mean, this is a debate that's going to go on. And I mean, even within the United States, I mean, Ohio swears that, you know, they were first in flight even before the Wright brothers. So I think this is just going to be an odd argument that will go on ad nauseum.
I think so. All right. We also heard from Ken. He's a CRJ first officer. He says it was nice to hear David Vanderhoof make mention of the Rolls-Royce RB211 in his This Week in Aviation History. However, I thought the brief mention of the RB211 deserved a little more attention just in regards to its impact on the marketing competition between the L1011 and the DC-10. And so Ken provides some interesting feedback, some details. He says, I've heard that many would blame the RB211 for the L1011's loss in the marketing competition with the DC-10. He says the engine was long overdue. It put the L1011 behind schedule. Based on this, some say that many potential orders were lost by Lockheed that instead went to the DC-10. He also says it was also my understanding that of the two aircraft, the L-1011 is the better engineered of the two. So this just goes to show that the better product doesn't always win. He says also, I've always wondered why Lockheed was so committed to the RB-211 and didn't make other engine options available, as did Douglas. I think in the end, this hurt them.
Can I just say that I have a thing for RV211 powered 757s? I just wanted to let everyone know.
Well, but you have to explain that now.
So because it's just such a, you know, Vinay's going to mock me and say for saying this, but they just have such a luscious thrust to weight ratio.
Luscious, huh?
You know what? I am not going to mock you, Dan. You know that I am a big fan of all things Rolls-Royce engines, so no, I will not mock you.
Oh, see, I thought that line was on the same par as I believe what I, the phrase I uttered to you this summer, which I believe was Star Alliance hotness.
Yes, that one I will mock you on.
All right, we want to thank Ken. Ken sent in some other comments, too, on the L-1011, and I want to thank Ken for that. Let's see, Gary wrote in, greetings from New Zealand. He says, a few years ago I read that modern airliners have angle of attack sensors, but the information from these sensors go only to the aircraft's flight computers, not directly to the flight crew. If this is true, and given that the angle of attack determines whether an aircraft flies or falls, what is the reason this information was not available to the flight crew? I think I've heard this also. I think we'll need to defer this to either Rob when he gets back, or any pilots in the audience that can help us with that. And I think we've touched on that a little bit, but so we'll defer that to Rob when he gets back. Finally, several listeners wrote in to take issue with our understanding of geography, and of course they're right. Both Phil and Jeremy pointed out that unlike what we said previously, the capital of New Mexico is not Albuquerque, but is in fact Santa Fe.
Good job, everybody. I'm proud of this team.
Yeah, wasn't that you that...
No, I wasn't on this episode. That was power outage episode.
Oh, that was power outage episode.
Don't blame this on me.
Okay.
We can blame this on the American education system instead.
It's a sad commentary. Well, I can say that probably 40 years ago I knew all of the state capitals, but that is no longer the case. So I think that'll do it for this episode. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Henry Hartevelt. Henry, thanks again for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you again for inviting me.
Also, special thanks to Benay Wilson for sitting in. Benay, thank you. Maybe you can tell folks where they can find you online.
You can find me at aviationweek.com/biz. On Twitter, I'm avweekbenet, B-E-N-E-T. And you can check out my personal website, which is aviationqueen.com.
And we want to thank Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report. You can find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. So let's tell folks where they can find us online. Let's see. Dan, it's just you and me, buddy. Where can they find you?
You can find me online, but before you do that, you have to believe in the power of dreams. Once you do that, thingsinthesky.com.
Oh, that's magic. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. Also on Twitter at Max Flight. Show notes can be found at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 164. Be sure to check that out. We'll have links to all the sites that we mentioned, also the contact information for all of us, as well as Henry and Benay. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. If you want to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have our listener line where you can leave an audio message. And since we have Benay live, she can tell us what that number is.
The Airplane Geeks are waiting for your call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Fantastic. Thanks, Benay. As always, opening and closing music provided by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
We're done?
Not until you say goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye now. Miss you. Thanks. Bye-bye. the way, since I haven't talked to you in a while, Henrik, congratulations on the new gig.
Thank you.
Are you staying in San Francisco, or what's going on? Oh, okay, just wondering.
Yeah. No, staying in San Francisco. No change there.
What, Anthony? What's wrong?
No, I'm just envious that Henry is in San Francisco.
Oh, great town!
You're
welcome to come visit.
It's my hometown.
By the way, Henry, the way things have been going thus far this year, I may take you up on your dating strategy that you suggested earlier this year.
Oh, dear Lord.
I'm not sure I want to know what that is.
I was going to say.
Well, no, Binet, I think I told you this one. I think Henry would take me to his street corner in San Francisco and yell, "Behold, it's a straight man," and then we'll see what happens.
Probably not much.
Well, it depends on which corner you are in San Francisco.
That's true.
I'm a sad person.
Oh, man.
But look, me and my girlfriend Microsoft Excel are just fine.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
She pivots quite nicely. Ba-da-pooch! Yeah, so I think this is... damn it. Already gone. Oh, damn, did my lamp get in the recording?
Your lamp?
Whatever. Yeah, I was changing my lamp.
For God's sake.
Well, there was a lot of racket. I'm not sure if it was coming from you or not, but...
Oh, okay. Well, I accidentally also kicked a container of Tums earlier. Anyway, just moving around...
You have a container of Tums that's large enough to kick?
Well, I was accidentally on the floor. It's just, you know, this. Okay. Anyway, moving on. I'd just like to confirm that Henry always looks super stylish whenever I see him.
And I can second that. I have never seen Henry look bad.
Very good, Henry.
Thank you.
All right. Okay.
It's sort of like how I always look good. Like, obviously, when the first, you know, when Binet's met me for the first time, her first reaction was, "Damn, I want a piece of that." So.
That wasn't you, Dan. That was the sandwich you had on your plate.
Have you got some questions for Henry?
Just so many that just aren't appropriate for this show.
I have a question for Henry.
Oh, God.
Yes, Binet.
What do you mean, oh, God?
And I'd just like to point out, Dan, that you're still not old enough to rent a car without paying a premium.
That is true.
Yeah, touche.
Which is probably good for society based on my driving skills sometimes.
Oh, good.
Oh, there you go, Dan. You're really building yourself up now. Women are going to fall all over themselves for you.
I think the women will eventually come because I've classed myself up at late. I mean, for example, now I shop the Banana Republic outlet, so I'm pretty awesome.
All right, we still got everybody?
Still here.
Okay.
Still here.
All right.
I'm always here for you, Max.
All right, fantastic.
I will be by your side.
Dan, you're hopeless.
Yeah, I'm just checking.
As of the 7th.
Bits and pieces was 163, so yes.
Can you give me a level, mate, please?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
You're not on the level at all.
No, I've never.
Just for once.
And then that's a completely different story.
Dateline, September 10,
2011. Hi, I'm Anthony Simmons, and this is the Australia Desk.
No, it's not.
This is the Australia Desk with a 206 taking off in the background.
Okay.
And I think even though we mentioned it...
Goodness, shut up.
Yep, thanks.
Ben, you know, we wanted to compare the skills of the modern Australian air traffic controller with some people who are slightly older and may have been an air traffic controller at one point. What would your thoughts be on that?
You were throwing that to Ben.
I don't have anything to say to that.
The air traffic controller is speechless once again.
Yeah, we've got to wrap this up. We're going
over
time.
Come on, I don't want to rag on another air traffic controller.
That's all right, he isn't one now.
The airplane geeks are waiting for your call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Fantastic. Thanks, Binet.
You're welcome.
Thank God that Binet actually knows our number now.
I know, last time she flew it.
By bite me.
Oh. Wonder if I'll bleep that or not. Maybe not.
You have one little off time.
Who pissed in your Cheerios this morning?
Actually, Dion made a very lovely breakfast this morning. No Cheerios for me.
That's good. I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't know where the echo's coming from, but that's a wrap. That's it.